abs on his hands where he'd driven nails into his flesh. He was as fond of the frown as Scopeek of the grin, though the look of a philosopher sat badly on a face better suited to a comedian, with its blob nose that perpetually ran, its teeth too widely spread, and eyebrows like hairy caterpillars that concertinaed when he furrowed his forehead. He was kept, along with 20 or so other prisoners judged exceptionally seditious, in the deepest part of the asylum, his windowless cell guarded more vigorously than those of the prisoners on higher floors. It had thus taken some fancy manoeuvring on Scopeek's part to get access to him, and the bribed guard, an Ethac, was only willing to turn a hooded eye for a few minutes. The ceremony was therefore short, conducted in an ad hoc mixture of Latin and English, with a few phrases pronounced in the language of Athanasius's Second Dominion Order, the Dirthers, the music of which more than compensated for its unintelligibility. The oaths themselves were necessarily spare, given the constraints of time and the redundance of most of the conventional vocabulary. "This isn't done in the sight of Hypaxamendios," Athanasius said, "nor in the sight of any god or the agent of any god. We pray that the presence of Our Lady may, however, touch this union with her infinite compassion, and that you go together into the great union at some higher time. Until then, I can only be as a glass held up to your sacrament, which is performed in your sight for your sake." The full significance of these words didn't strike Gentle until later, when, with the oaths made and the ceremony done, he lay down in his cell beside his partner. "I always said I'd never marry," he whispered to the mystiff. "Regretting it already?" "Not at all. But it's strange to be married and not have a wife."
"You can't call me wife. You can call me whatever you want. Reinvent me, that's what I'm for."
"I didn't marry you to use you, Pye."
"That's part of it, though. We must be functions of each other. Mirrors, maybe."
It touched Gentle's face.
"I'll use you, believe me."
"For what?"
"For everything. Comfort, argument, pleasure."
"I do want to learn from you."
"About what?"
"How to fly out of my head again the way I did this afternoon. How to travel by mind."
"By moat," Pye said,
echoing the way Gentle had felt as he'd driven his thoughts through Narshap's skull.
"Meaning a particle of thought, as seen in sunlight."
"It can only be done in sunlight?"
"No, it's just easier that way. Almost everything's easier in sunlight."
"Except this,"
Gentle said, kissing the mischief.
"I've always preferred the night for this."
He had come to their marriage bed determined that he would make love with the mischief as it truly was, allowing no fantasy to intrude between his senses and the vision he'd glimpsed in Nashup's office. That oath made him as nervous as a virgin groom, demanding as it did a double unveiling. Just as he unbuttoned and discarded the clothes that concealed the mischief's essential sex, so he had to tear from his eyes the comfort of the illusions that lay between his sight and its object. What would he feel then? It was easy to be aroused by a creature so totally reconfigured by desire that it was indistinguishable from the thing desired. But what of the configurer itself, seen naked by naked eyes? In the shadows its body was almost feminine, its planes serene, its surface smooth. But there was an austerity in its sinew he couldn't pretend was womanly, nor were its buttocks lush or its chest ripe. It was not his wife, and though it was happy to be imagined that way, and his mind teetered over and over on the edge of giving in to such invention, he resisted, demanding his eyes hold to their focus and his fingers to the facts. He began to wish it were lighter in the cell, so as not to give ease to ambiguity. When he put his hand into the shadow between its legs and felt the heat and motion there, he said,
"I want to see."
And Pye dutifully stood up in the light from the window, so that Gentle could have a plainer view. His heart was pumping furiously, but none of the blood was reaching his groin. It was filling his head, making his face burn. He was glad he sat in shadow, where his discomfort was less visible, though he knew that shadow concealed only the outward show, and the mischief was perfectly aware of the fear he felt. He took a deep breath and got up from the bed, crossing to within touching distance of this enigma.
Why are you doing this to yourself?
Pi asked softly.
Why not let the dreams come?
Because I don't want to dream you,
he said.
I came on this journey to understand. How can I understand anything if all I look at is illusions?
Maybe that's all there is.
That isn't true, he said simply.
Tomorrow, then,
Pi said temptingly.
Look plainly tomorrow. Just enjoy yourself tonight. I'm not the reason we're in the Imagica. I'm not the puzzle you came to solve.
On the contrary,
Gentle said, a smile creeping into his voice.
I think maybe you are the reason. And the puzzle. I think if we stayed here, locked up together, we could heal the Imagica from what's between us.
The smile appeared on his face now.
I never realized that till now. That's why I want to see you clearly, Pi, so there are no lies between us.
He put his hand against the Mistiff's sex.
You could fuck or be fucked with this, right?
Yes.
And you could give birth?
I haven't. But it's been known.
And fertilize?
Yes.
That's wonderful. And is there something else you can do?
Like what?
It isn't all doer or done to, is it?
I know it isn't.
There's something else.
Yes, there is.
A third way.
Yes.
Do it with me, then.
I can't. You're male, Gentle. You're a fixed sex. It's a physical fact.
The Mistiff put his hand on Gentle's prick, still soft in his trousers.
I can't take this away. You wouldn't want me to.
It frowned.
Would you?
I don't know. Maybe.
You don't mean that. If it meant finding a way, maybe I do. I've used my dick every way I know how. Maybe it's redundant.
Now it was Pi's turn to smile, but such a fragile smile, as though the unease Gentle had felt now burdened the Mistiff instead. It narrowed its shining eyes.
What are you thinking?
Gentle said.
How you make me a little afraid.
Of what?
Of the pain ahead. Of losing you.
You're not going to lose me,
Gentle said, putting his hand around the back of Pi's neck and stroking the nape with his thumb.
I told you, we could heal the Imagica from here. We're strong, Pi.
The anxiety didn't go from the Mistiff's face, so Gentle coaxed its face towards his and kissed it, first discreetly, then with an ardour it seemed reluctant to match. Only moments before, sitting on the bed, he'd been the tentative one. Now it was the other way around. He put his hand down to its groin, hoping to distract it from its sadness with caresses. The flesh came to meet his fingers, warm and fluted, trickling into the shallow cup of his palmar moisture his skin drank like liquor. He pressed deeper, feeling the elaboration grow at his touch. There was no hesitation here, no shame or sorrow in this flesh to keep it from displaying its need, and need had never failed to arouse him. Seeing it on a woman's face was a sure aphrodisiac, and it was no less so now. He reached up from this play to his belt, unbuckling it with one hand, but before he could take hold of his prick, which was becoming painfully hard, the Mistiff did so, guiding him inside it with an urgency its face still failed to betray. The bath of its sex soothed his ache, immersing him balls and all. He let out a long sigh of pleasure, his nerve endings, starved of this sensation for months, rioting. The Mistiff had closed its eyes, its mouth open. He put his tongue hard between his lips, and it responded with a passion he had never seen it manifest before. Its hands wrapped around his shoulders, and in possession of them both it fell back against the wall, so hard the breath went from it into Gentle's throat. He drew it down into his lungs, inciting a hunger for more, which the Mistiff understood without need of words, inhaling from the heated air between them and filling Gentle's chest as though he were a just drowned man being pumped back to life. He answered its gift with thrusts, its fluids running freely down the inside of his thighs. It gave him another breath and another. He drank them all, eating the pleasure off its face in the moments between, the breath received as his prick was given. In this exchange they were both entered and enterer, a hint, perhaps, of the third way Pi had spoken of, the coupling between unfixed forces that could not occur until his manhood had been taken from him. Now, as he worked his prick against the warmth of the mistiff's sex, the thought of relinquishing it in pursuit of another sensation seemed ludicrous. There could be nothing better than this. Only different. He closed his eyes, no longer afraid that his imagination would put a memory or some invented perfection in Pi's place, only that if he looked at the mistiff's bliss too much longer, he'd lose all control. What his mind's eye pictured, however, was more potent still. The image of them locked together as they were, inside each other, breath and prick, swelling inside each other's skins until they could swell no further. He wanted to warn the mistiff that he could hold on no longer, but it seemed to have that news already. It grasped his hair, pulling him off its face, the sting of it just another spur now, and the sobs too coming out of them both. He let his eyes open, wanting to see its face as he came, and in the time it took for his lashes to unknit, the beauty in front of him became a mirror. It was his face he was seeing, his body he was holding. The illusion didn't cool him. Quite the reverse. Before the mirror softened into flesh, its glass becoming the sweat on Pi's sweet face, he passed the point of no return, and it was with that image in his eye, his face mingled with the mistiff's, that his body unleashed its little torrent. It was, as ever, exquisite and racking, a short delirium followed by a sense of loss he'd never made peace with. The mistiff began to laugh almost before he was finished. And when Gentle drew his first clear breath, it was to ask, "What's so funny?" "The silence," Pi said, suppressing the music so that Gentle could share the joke. He'd lain here in this cell hour after hour, unable to make a moan, but he'd never heard a silence such as this. The whole asylum was listening, from the depths where Father Athanasius wove his piercing crowns to Nashap's office, its carpet indelibly marked with the blood his nose had shed. There was not a waking soul who'd not heard their coupling. "Such a silence," the mistiff said. As it spoke, the hush was broken by the sound of someone yelling in his cell, a rage of loss and loneliness that went on unchecked for the rest of the night, as if to cleanse the grey stone of the joy that had momentarily tainted it. Chapter 27 1. If pressed, Jude could have named a dozen men, lovers, suitors, slaves, who'd offered her any prize she set her heart on in return for her affections. She'd taken several up on their largesse, but her requests, extravagant as some of them had been, were as nothing beside the gift she'd asked of Oscar Godolphin. "Show me Isorderex," she'd said, and watched his face fill with trepidation. He'd not refused her out of hand. To have done so would have crushed in a moment the affection growing between them, and he would never have forgiven himself that loss. He listened to her request and made no further mention of it, hoping, no doubt, she'd let the subject lie. She didn't, however. The blossoming of a physical relationship between them had cured her of the strange passivity that had afflicted her when they'd first met. She had knowledge of his vulnerability now. She'd seen him wounded. She'd seen him ashamed of his lack of self-control. She'd seen him in the act of love, tender and sweetly perverse. Though her feelings for him remained strong, this new perspective removed the veil of unthinking acceptance from her eyes. Now, when she saw the desire he felt for her, and he several times displayed that desire in the days following their consummation, it was the old Judith, self-reliant and fearless, who watched from behind her smiles. Watched and waited, knowing that his devotion empowered her more by the day. The tension between these two selves, the remnants of the compliant mistress his presence had first conjured, and the willful, focused woman she'd been, and now was again, scourged the last dregs of dreaminess from her system, and her appetite for dominion-hopping returned with fresh intensity. She didn't shrink from reminding him of his promise to her as the days went by, but on the first two occasions he made some polite but spurious excuse so as to avoid talking further about it. On the third occasion her insistence won her a sigh and eyes cast to heaven.
"Why is this so important to you?" he asked. "Isorderex is an overpopulated cesspit. I don't know a decent man or woman there who wouldn't prefer to be here in England.
A week ago you were talking about disappearing there forever. But you couldn't, you said, because you'd miss the cricket.
You've got a good memory.
I hang on your every word, she said, not without a certain sourness.
Well, the situation's changed. There's most likely going to be revolution. If we went now, we'd probably be executed on sight.
You've come and gone often enough in the past, she pointed out. So have hundreds of others, haven't they? You're not the only one. That's what magic is for, passing between dominions. He didn't reply. I want to see Isorderex, Oscar, she said, and if you won't take me, I'll find a magician who will.
Don't even joke about it.
I mean it, she said fiercely. You can't be the only one who knows the way.
Near enough.
There are others. I'll find them if I have to.
They're all crazy, he told her, or dead.
Murdered, she said, the word out of her mouth before she'd fully grasped its implication. The look on his face, however, or rather its absence, the willed blankness, was enough to confirm her suspicion. The bodies she'd seen on the news being carted away from their games were not those of burned-out hippies and sex-crazed Satanists. They were possessors of true power, men and women who'd maybe walked where she longed to walk, in the Imagica. Who's doing it, Oscar? It's somebody you know, isn't it? He got up and crossed to where she sat, his motion so swift she thought for an instant he meant to strike her. But instead he dropped to his knees in front of her, holding her hands tight and staring up at her with almost hypnotic intensity.
Listen to me carefully, he said. I have certain familial duties which I wish to God I didn't have. They make demands upon me I'd willingly shrug off if I could.
This is all to do with the tower, isn't it?
I prefer not to discuss that.
We are discussing it, Oscar.
It's a very private and a very delicate business. I'm dealing with individuals quite without any sense of morality. If they were to know that I've said even this much to you, both our lives would be in the direst jeopardy. I beg you, never utter another word about this to anyone. I should never have taken you up to the tower.
If its occupants were half as murderous as he was suggesting, she thought, how much more lethal would they be if they knew how many of the tower's secrets she'd seen?
Promise me you'll let this subject alone, he went on.
I want to see Isorderex, Oscar.
Promise me. No more talk about the tower, in this house or out of it. Say it, Judith.
All right. I won't talk about the tower.
In this house or out of it.
But, Oscar...
What, sweet?
I still want to see Isorderex.
2. The morning after this exchange, she went up to Highgate. It was another rainy day, and failing to find an unoccupied cab, she braved the underground. It was a mistake. She'd never liked travelling by tube at the best of times. It brought out her latent claustrophobia, but she recalled as she rode that two of those murdered in the spate of killings had died in these tunnels, one pushed in front of a crowded train as it drew into Piccadilly Station, the other stabbed to death at midnight, somewhere on the Jubilee line. This was not a safe way to travel for someone who had even the slightest inkling of the prodigies half hidden in the world. And she was one of those few. So it was with no little relief she stepped out into the open air at Archway's station. The clouds had cleared, and started up Highgate Hill on foot. She had no difficulty finding the tower itself, though the banality of its design, together with the shield of trees in full leaf in front of it, meant few eyes were likely to look its way. Despite the dire warnings issued by Oscar, it was difficult to find much intimidating about the place, with the spring sunshine warm enough to make her slip off her jacket, and the grass busy with sparrows quarrelling over worms raised by the rain. She scanned the windows looking for some sign of occupation, but saw none. Avoiding the front door with its camera trained on the step, she headed down the side of the building, her progress unimpeded by walls or barbed wire. The owners had clearly decided the tower's best defence lay in its utter lack of character, and the less they did to keep trespassers out, the fewer would be attracted in the first place. There was even less to see from the back than the front. There were blinds down over most of the windows, and those few that were not covered let on to empty rooms. She made a complete circuit of the tower looking for some other way into it, but there was none. As she returned to the front of the building, she tried to imagine the passageways buried beneath her feet, the books piled in the darkness, and the imprisoned soul lying in a deeper darkness still, hoping her mind might be able to go where her body could not. But that exercise proved as fruitless as her window watching. The real world was implacable. It wouldn't shift a particle of soil to let her through. Discouraged, she made one final circuit of the tower, then decided to give up. Maybe she'd come back here at night, she thought, when solid reality didn't insist on her senses so brutally. Or maybe seek another journey under the influence of the blue eye, though this option made her nervous. She had no real grasp of the mechanism by which the eye induced such flights, and she feared giving it power over her. Oscar already had enough of that. She put her jacket back on and headed away from the tower. To judge by the absence of traffic on Hornsey Lane, the hill, which had been clogged with traffic, was still blocked, preventing drivers from making their way in this direction. The gulf, usually filled with the dinner vehicles, was not empty, however. There were footsteps close behind her. And a voice.
"Who are you?"
She glanced around, not assuming the question was directed at her, but finding that she and the questioner, a woman in her 60s, shabbily dressed and sickly, were the only people in sight. Moreover, the woman's stare was fixed upon her with a near manic intensity. Again, the question, coming from a mouth that had about it a spittle-flecked asymmetry that suggested the speaker had suffered a stroke in the past.
"Who are you?"
Already irritated by her failure at the tower, Judith was in no mood to humour what was plainly the local schizophrenic, and was turning on her heel to walk away when the woman spoke again.
"Don't you know they'll hurt you?"
"Who will?" she said.
"The people in the tower, the tabula rasa. What were you looking for?"
"Nothing."
"You were looking very hard for nothing.
Are you spying for them?" The woman made an ugly sound that Judith took to be a laugh.
"They don't even know I'm alive," she said.
Then, for the third time,
"Who are you?"
"My name's Judith."
"I'm Clara Leash,"
the woman said. She cast a glance back in the direction of the tower.
"Walk on," she said. "There's a church halfway up the hill. I'll meet you there."
"What is all this about?"
"At the church, not here."
So saying, she turned her back on Judith and walked off, her agitation enough to dissuade Judith from following. Two words in their short exchange convinced her she should wait at the church and find out what Clara Leash had to say, however. Those words were tabula rasa. She hadn't heard them spoken since her conversation with Charlie at the estate, when he told her how he'd been passed over for membership in favour of Oscar. He'd made light of it at the time, and much of what he'd said had been blotted from her mind by the violence and the revelations that followed. Now she found herself digging for recollections of what he'd said about the organisation, something about the tainted soil of England, and her saying tainted by what, and Charlie making some comical reply. Now she knew what that taint was. Magic. In that bland tower, the lives of the men and women whose bodies had been found in shallow graves or scraped from the rails of the Piccadilly line had been judged and found corrupt. No wonder Oscar was losing weight and sobbing in his sleep. He was a member of a society formed for the express purpose of eradicating a second and diminishing society to which he also belonged. For all his self-possession, he was the servant of two masters, magic and its despoiler. It fell to her to help him by whatever means she could. She was his lover, and without her aid he would eventually be crushed between contrary imperatives, and he in his turn was her ticket to his Orderex, without whom she would never see the glories of the Imagica. They needed each other, alive and sane. She waited at the church for half an hour, before Clara Leash appeared, looking fretful.
"Out here's no good," she said. "Inside."
They stepped into the gloomy building and sat close to the altar, so as not to be overheard by the three noontime supplicants who were at their prayers towards the back. It was not an ideal place in which to have a whispered conversation. Their sibilance carried even if the sense did not, its echoes coming back to meet them off the bare walls. Nor was there much trust between them to begin with. To defend herself from Clara's glare, Judith spent the early part of their exchange with her back half turned to the woman, only facing her fully when they disposed of the circumlocutions, and she felt confident enough to ask the question most on her mind.
"What do you know about the tabula rasa?"
"Everything that is to know," Clara replied.
"I was a member of the society for many years."
"But they think you're dead?"
"They're not far wrong. I haven't got more than a few months left, which is why it's important I pass along what I know."
"To me?"
"That depends," she said.
"First, I want to know what you were doing at the tower."
"I was looking for a way in."
"Have you ever been inside?"
"Yes and no."
"Meaning what?"
"My mind's been inside, even though my body hasn't," Judith said, fully expecting a repeat of Clara's weird little laugh in response. Instead, the woman said,
"On the night of December the 31st.
"How the hell did you know that?" Clara put her hand up to Judith's face. Her fingers were icy cold.
"First, you should know how I departed the tabula rasa."
Although she told her story without embellishments, it took some time, given that so much of what she was explaining required footnotes for Judith to fully comprehend its significance. Clara, like Oscar, was the descendant of one of the society's founding members, and had been brought up to believe in its basic principles. England, tainted by magic, indeed almost destroyed by it, had to be protected from any cult or individual who sought to educate new generations in its corrupt practices. When Judith asked how this near destruction had come about, Clara's answer was a story in itself. 200 years ago, this coming midsummer, she explained, a ritual had been attempted that had gone tragically awry. Its purpose had been to reconcile the reality of Earth with those of 4 other dimensions.
"The Dominions," Judith said,
dropping her voice, which was already low, lower still.
"Say it out loud," Clara replied. "Dominions! Dominions!"
She only raised her voice to speaking volume, but after such a time whispering, it was shockingly loud.
"It's been a secret for too long," she said, "and that gives the enemy power."
"Who is the enemy?"
"There are so many," she said. "In this dominion, the tabula rasa and its servants, and it's got plenty of those, believe me, in the very highest places."
"How?"
"It's not difficult when your members are the descendants of kingmakers. And if influence fails, you can always buy your way past democracy. It's going on all the time."
"And in the other dominions?"
"Getting information's more difficult, especially now. I knew 2 women who regularly passed between here and the reconciled dominions. One of them was found dead a week ago. The others disappeared. She may also have been murdered."
"By the tabula rasa?"
"You know a good deal, don't you? What's your source?"
Judith had known Clara would ask that question eventually, and had been trying to decide how she would answer it. Her belief in Clara Leash's integrity grew apace, but wouldn't it be precipitous to share with a woman she'd taken for a bag lady only 2 hours before a secret that could be Oscar's death warrant if known to the tabula rasa?
"I can't tell you my source," she said. "This person's in great danger as it is."
"And you don't trust me?"
She raised her hand to ward off any protest.
"Don't sweet-talk me," she said. "You don't trust me, and why should I blame you? But let me ask this. Is this source of yours a man?"
"Yes." "Why?"
"You asked me before who the enemy was, and I said the tabula rasa. But we've got a more obvious enemy. The opposite sex."
"What?"
"Men, Judith. The destroyers."
"Oh, now wait.
They used to be goddesses throughout the dominions. Powers that took our sex's part in the cosmic drama. They're all dead, Judith. They didn't just die of old age. They were systematically eradicated by the enemy."
"Ordinary men don't kill goddesses."
"Ordinary men serve extraordinary men. Extraordinary men get their visions from the gods, and gods kill goddesses.
That's too simple. It sounds like a school lesson. Learn it, then, and if you can, disprove it. I'd like that. Truly I would. I'd like to discover that the goddesses are all in hiding somewhere. Like the woman under the tower?
For the first time in this dialogue, Clara was lost for words. She simply stared, leaving Jude to fill the silence of her astonishment.
When I said I've been into the tower in my mind, that isn't strictly true, Jude said. I've only been under the tower. There's a cellar there, like a maze. It's full of books. And behind one of the walls there's a woman. I thought she was dead at first, but she isn't. She's maybe close to it, but she's holding on.
Clara was visibly shaken by this account.
I thought I was the only one who knew she was there, she said.
More to the point, do you know who she is?
I've got a pretty good idea,
Clara said, and picked up the story she'd been diverted from earlier, the tale of how she'd come to leave the Tabula Rasa. The library beneath the tower, she explained, was the most comprehensive collection of manuscripts dealing with the occult sciences, but more particularly the legends and lore of the Imagica, in the world. It had been gathered by the men who'd founded the society, led by Roxburgh and Godolphin, to keep from the hands and minds of innocent Englishmen the stain of things immagical. But rather than cataloguing the collection, making an index of these forbidden books, generations of the Tabula Rasa had simply left them to fester.
I took it upon myself to sort through the collection. Believe it or not, I was once a very ordered woman. I got it from my father. He was in the military. At first I was watched by two other members of the society. That's the law. No member of the society is allowed into the library alone, and if anyone judges either of the other two to be in any way unduly interested or influenced by the volumes, they can be tried by the society and executed. I don't think it's ever been done. Half the books are in Latin, and who reads Latin? The other half, you've seen for yourself, they're rotting on their spines, like all of us. But I wanted order, the way Daddy would have liked it, everything neat and tidy. My companions soon got tired of my obsession and left me to it, and in the middle of the night I felt something, or somebody, pulling at my thoughts, plucking them out of my scalp, one by one, like hairs. Of course I thought it was the books at first. I thought the words had got some power over me. I tried to leave, but you know, I really didn't want to. I'd been Daddy's repressed little daughter for 50 years, and I was about ready to crack. Celestine knew it too.
Celestine is the woman in the wall?
I believe it's her, yes.
But you don't know who she is?
I'm coming to that,
Clara said.
Roxburgh's house stood on the land where the tower now stands. The cellar is the cellar of that house. Celestine was, indeed still is, Roxburgh's prisoner. He walled her up because he didn't dare kill her. She'd seen the face of Hepexamendios, the god of gods. She was insane. But she'd been touched by divinity, and even Roxburgh didn't dare lay a finger on her.
How do you know all this?
Roxburgh wrote a confession a few days before he died. He knew the woman he'd walled up would outlive him by centuries, and I suppose he also knew that sooner or later somebody would find her. So the confession was also a warning to whatever poor, victimized man came along, telling him that she was not to be touched. "Bury her again," he said. I remember that very clearly. Bury her again in the deepest abyss your wits may devise.
Where did you find this confession?
In the wall, that night when I was alone. I believe Celestine led me to it, by plucking thoughts out of my head and putting new ones in. But she plucked too hard. My mind gave up. I had a stroke down there. I wasn't found for 3 days.
That's horrible.
My suffering's nothing compared to hers. Roxburgh had found this woman in London, or his spies had, and he knew she was a creature of immense power. He probably realized it more clearly than she did, in fact, because he says in the confession she was a stranger to herself. But she'd seen sights no other human being had ever witnessed. She'd been snatched from the Fifth Dominion, escorted across the Imagica, and taken into the presence of Hapex Amendios. Why? It gets stranger. When he interrogated her, she told him she'd been brought back into the Fifth Dominion pregnant. She was having God's child. That's what she told Roxburgh. She could have been inventing it all, just to keep him from hurting her. I don't think he'd have done that. In fact, I think he was half in love with her. He said in the confession he felt like his friend Godolphin. "I'm broken by a woman's eye," he wrote. That's an odd phrase, Jude thought, thinking of the stone as she did so, its stare, its authority. Well, Godolphin died obsessing on some mistress he'd loved and lost, claiming he'd been destroyed by her. The men were always the innocents, you see, victims of female connivings. I dare say Roxburgh persuaded himself that walling Celestine up was an act of love, keeping her under his thumb forever.
What happened to the child? Judith said.
Maybe she can tell us herself, Clara replied.
Then we have to get her out.
Indeed.
Do you have any idea how?
Not yet, Clara said. Until you appeared, I was ready to despair. But between the two of us, we'll find some way to save her.
It was getting late, and Jude was anxious that her absence not been noted, so the plans they laid were sketchy in the extreme. A further examination of the tower was clearly in order, this time, Clara proposed, under cover of darkness.
Tonight, she suggested.
No, that's too soon. Give me a day to make up some excuse for being out for the night.
Who's the watchdog? Clara said.
Just a man.
Suspicious?
Sometimes.
Well, Celestine's waited a long time to be set free. She can wait another 24 hours. But please, no longer. I'm not a well woman.
Jude put her hand over Clara's hand, the first contact between them since the woman had touched her icy fingers to Jude's cheek.
You're not going to die, she said.
Oh, yes, I am. It's no great hardship. But I want to see Celestine's face before I leave.
We will, Judith said. If not tomorrow night, soon after.
3. She didn't believe what Clara had said about men pertained to Oscar. He was no destroyer of goddesses, either by hand or proxy. But Dowd was another matter entirely. Though his facade was civilized, almost prissy at times, she would never forget the casual way he disposed of the voider's bodies, warming his hands at the pyre as though they were branches, not bones that were cracking in the flames. And, as bad luck would have it, Dowd was back at the house when she returned and Oscar was not, so it was his questions she was obliged to answer if she wasn't to arouse his suspicions with silence. When he asked her what she'd done with the day, she told him she'd gone out for a long walk along the embankment. He then inquired as to whether the tube had been crowded, though she'd not told him she'd travelled that way. She said it was. "You should take a cab next time," he said. "Or, better still, allow me to drive you. I'm certain Mr. Godolphin would prefer you to travel in comfort," he said. She thanked him for his kindness. "Will you be planning other trips soon?" he asked. She had her story for the following evening already prepared, but Dowd's manner never failed to throw her off balance, and she was certain any lie she told now would be instantly spotted, so she said she didn't know and let the subject drop. Oscar didn't come home until the middle of the night, slipping into bed beside her as gently as his bulk allowed. She pretended to wake. He murmured a few words of apology for stirring her, and then some of love. Feigning a sleepy tone, she told him she was going to see her friend Clem tomorrow night, and did he mind? He told her she should do whatever she wanted, but keep her beautiful body for him. Then he kissed her shoulder and neck and fell asleep. She had arranged to meet Clara at 8 in the evening outside the church, but she left for that rendezvous 2 hours before in order to go via her old flat. She didn't know what place in the scheme of things the carved blue eye had, but she decided the night before that it should be with her when they made their attempt to liberate Celestine. The flat felt cold and neglected, and she spent only a few minutes there, first retrieving the eye from her wardrobe, then quickly leafing through the mail, most of it junk, that had arrived since she'd last visited. These tasks completed, she set out for Highgate, taking Dowd's advice and hailing a taxi to do so. It delivered her to the church 25 minutes early, only to find that Clara was already there.
"Have you eaten, my girl?"
Clara wanted to know. Jude told her she had.
"Good," Clara said. "We'll need all our strength tonight."
"Before we go any further," Jude said, "I want to show you something. I don't know what use it can be to us, but I think you ought to see it."
She brought the parcel of cloth out of her bag.
"Remember what you said about Celestine plucking the thoughts out of your head?"
"Of course."
"This is what did the same to me."
She began to unwrap the eye, a subtle tremor in her fingers as she did so. 4 months and more had passed since she'd hidden it away with such superstitious care, but her memory of its effect was undimmed, and she half expected it to exercise some power now. It did nothing, though. It lay in the folds of its covering, looking so unremarkable she was almost embarrassed to have made such a show of unveiling it. Clara, however, stared at it with a smile on her lips.
"Where did you get this?" she said.
"I'd rather not say."
"This is no time for secrets," Clara snapped. "How did you come by it?"
"It was given to my husband, my ex-husband."
"Who by?"
"His brother."
"And who's his brother?"
She took a deep breath, undecided even as she drew it whether she'd expel it again as truth or fabrication.
"His name's Oscar Godolphin," she said.
At this reply, Clara physically retreated from Judith, almost as though this name was proof of the plague.
"Do you know Oscar Godolphin?"
she said, her tone appalled.
"Yes, I do."
"Is he the watchdog?"
she said.
"Yes, he is."
"Cover it up,"
she said, shunning the eye now.
"Cover it up and put it away."
She turned her back on Judith, running her crabbed hands through her hair.
"You and Godolphin?"
she said, half to herself.
"What does that mean? What does that mean?"
"It doesn't mean anything," Jude said. "What I feel for him and what we're doing now are completely different issues."
"Don't be naive,"
Clara replied, glancing back at Jude.
"Godolphin's a member of the Tabula Rasa, and a man. You and Celestine are both women and his prisoners."
"I'm not his prisoner,"
Jude said, infuriated by Clara's condescension.
"I do what I want when I want."
"Until you defy history," Clara said. "Then you'll see how much he thinks he owns you."
She approached Jude again, taking her voice down to a pained whisper.
"Understand this," she said. "You can't save Celestine and keep his affections. You're going to be digging at the very foundations, literally the foundations of his family and his faith, and when he finds out, and he will when the Tabula Rasa starts to crumble, whatever's between you will mean nothing. We're not another sex, Judith. We're another species. What's going on in our bodies and our heads isn't remotely like what's going on in theirs. Our hells are different. So are our heavens. We're enemies, and you can't be on both sides in a war."
"It isn't war," Jude said. "If it was war, I'd be angry, and I've never been calmer."
"We'll see how calm you are when you see how things really stand."
Jude took another deep breath.
"Maybe we should stop arguing and do what we came to do," she said.
Clara looked at her balefully.
"I think stubborn bitch is the phrase you're looking for,"
Jude remarked.
I never trust the passive ones,
Clara said, betraying a trace of admiration.
I'll remember that.
The tower was in darkness, and the trees clogged the lamplight from the street, leaving the forecourt shadowy and the route down the flank of the building virtually lightless. Clara had obviously wandered here by night many times, however, because she went with confidence, leaving Jude to trail. Snared by the brambles and stung by the nettles, it had been easy to avoid in the sunshine. By the time she reached the back of the tower, her eyes were better accustomed to the murk and found Clara standing 20 yards from the building, staring at the ground.
"What are you doing back here?" Jude said. "We know there's only one way in."
"Barred and bolted," she said. "I'm thinking there may be some other entrance to the cellar under the turf, even if it's only a ventilation pipe. The first thing we should do is locate Celestine's cell."
"How do we do that?"
"We use the eye that took you travelling," Clara said. "Come on, come on, give it over."
"I thought it was too tainted to be touched."
"Not at all. The way you looked at it, it's loot, my girl. That's what repulsed me. It's a piece of women's history traded between two men."
"I'm sure Oscar didn't know what it was," she said, thinking even as she defended him that this was probably untrue.
"It belongs to a great temple."
"He certainly doesn't loot temples,"
Jude said, taking the contentious item from her pocket.
"I'm not saying he does," Clara replied. "The temples were brought down long before the line of the Godolphins was even founded." "Well, are you going to hand it over or not?"
Jude unwrapped the eye, discovering in herself a reluctance to share it she hadn't anticipated. It was no longer as unremarkable as it had been. It gave off a subtle luminescence, blue and steady, by which she and Clara could see each other, albeit faintly. Their gazes met, the eye's light gleaming between them like the glance of a third conspirator, a woman wiser than them both, whose presence, despite the dull murmur of traffic and jets droning through the clouds above, exalted the moment. Jude found herself wondering how many women had gathered in the glow of this light, or its like, down the ages, gathered to pray, or make sacrifice, or shelter from the destroyer. Countless numbers, no doubt, dead and forgotten, but in this brief time out of time, reclaimed from anonymity, not named, but at least acknowledged by these new acolytes. She looked away from Clara towards the eye. The solid world around her suddenly seemed irrelevant, at best a game of veils, at worst a trap in which the spirit struggled, and struggling gave credence to the lie. There was no need to be bound by its rules. She could fly beyond it with a thought. She looked up again to confirm that Clara was also ready to move, but her companion was glancing out of the circle towards the corner of the tower.
"What is it?"
Jude said, following the direction of Clara's gaze. Somebody was approaching them through the darkness, in the walk a nonchalance she could name in a syllable.
"Dowd." "You know him?"
Clara said.
"A little,"
Dowd said, his voice as casual as his gait.
"But really, there's so much she doesn't know."
Clara's hands dropped from Jude's, breaking the charm of three.
"Don't come any closer," Clara said.
Surprisingly, Dowd stopped dead in his tracks, a few yards from the women. There was sufficient light from the eye for Jude to pick out his face. Something, or things, seemed to be crawling around his mouth, as though he'd just eaten a handful of ants and a few had escaped from between his lips.
"I would so love to kill you both," he said,
and with the words further mites escaped and ran over his cheeks and chin.
"But your time will come, Judith. Very soon. For now, it's just Clara." "It is Clara, isn't it?"
"Go to hell, Dowd," Jude said.
"Step away from the old woman," Dowd replied.
Jude's response was to take hold of Clara's arm.
"You're not going to hurt anybody, you little shit," she said.
There was a fury rising in her, the like of which she'd not felt in months. The eye was heavy in her hand. She was ready to brain the bastard with it if he took a step towards them.
"Did you not understand me, whore?" he said, moving towards her as he did so. "I told you. Step away."
In her rage, She went to meet his approach, raising her weighted hand as she did so, but in the instant that she let go of Clara, he sidestepped her and she lost sight of him. Realizing that she'd done exactly as he'd planned, she reeled around, intending to take hold of Clara again, but he was there before her. She heard a shout of horror and saw Clara staggering away from her attacker. The mites were at her face already, blinding her. Jude ran to catch hold of her before she fell, but this time Dowd moved towards her, not away, and with a single blow struck the stone from Jude's hand. She didn't turn to reclaim it, but went to Clara's aid. The woman's moans were terrible, so were the tremors in her body.
"What have you done to her?"
she yelled at Dowd.
"Undone, lovely, undone. Let her be. You can't help her now."
Clara's body was light, but when her legs buckled, she carried Jude down with her. Her moans had become howls now as she reached up to her face, as if to scratch out her eyes, for there the mites were at some agonizing work. In desperation, Jude tried to feel for the creatures in the darkness, but either they were too fast for her fingers, or they'd gone where fingers couldn't follow. All she could do was beg for a reprieve.
"Make them stop," she said to Dowd. "Whatever you want, I'll do, but please make them stop."
"They're voracious little sods, aren't they?" he said.
He was crouching in front of the eye, the blue light illuminating his face, which wore a mask of chilling serenity. As she watched, he picked mites from around his mouth and let them drop to the ground.
"I'm afraid they've got no ears, so I can't call them back," he said. "They only know how to unmake, and they'll unmake anything but their maker. In this case, that's me. So I'd leave her alone if I were you. They're indiscriminate."
She turned her attention back to the woman in her arms. Clara had given up scratching at her eyes, and the tremors in her body were rapidly diminishing.
"Speak to me," Jude said.
She reached for Clara's face, a little ashamed of how tentative Dowd's warning had made her. There was no answer from the body, unless there were words in Clara's dying moans. Jude listened, hoping to find some vestigial sense there, but there was none. She felt a single spasm pass down Clara's spine as though something in her head had snapped, and then the whole system stopped dead. From the moment when Dowd had first appeared, perhaps 90 seconds had passed. In that time, every hope that had gathered here had been undone. She wondered if Celestine had heard this tragedy unfold, another's suffering adding to her own sum.
"Dead, then, lovey," Dowd said.
Jude let Clara's body slip from her arms into the grass.
"We should be going," he went on,
his tone so bland they might have been forsaking a picnic instead of a corpse.
"Don't worry about Clara. I'll fetch what's left of her later."
She heard the sound of his feet behind her and stood up rather than be touched by him. Overhead, another jet was roaring in the clouds. She looked towards the eye, but it too had been unmade.
"Destroyer," she said.
Chapter 28. 1. Gentle had forgotten his short exchange with Aping about their shared enthusiasm for painting, but Aping had not. The morning after the wedding in Athanasius's cell, the sergeant came to fetch Gentle and escorted him to a room at the other end of the building, which he had turned into a studio. It had plenty of windows, so the light was as good as this region was ever likely to supply, and he had gathered over the months of his posting here an enviable selection of materials. The products of this workplace were, however, those of the most uninspired dilettante. Designed without compositional skill and painted without sense of colour, their only real point of interest lay in their obsessiveness. There were, Aping proudly told Gentle, 153 pictures, and their subject was unchanging. His child, Hussar, the merest mention of whom had caused the loving portraitist such unease. Now, in the privacy of his place of inspiration, he explained why. His daughter was young, he said, and her mother dead. He'd been obliged to bring her with him when orders from Irmandus moved him to the cradle.
"I could have left her in Limby," he told Gentle, "but who knows what kind of harm she'd have come to if I'd done that. She's a child."
"So she's here on the island?"
"Yes, she is. But she won't step out of her room in the daytime.
She's afraid of catching the madness, she says. I love her very much, and as you can see, he indicated the paintings, she's very beautiful. Gentle was obliged to take the man's word for it. Where is she now? He asked.
Where she always is, Aping said. In her room. She has very strange dreams.
I know how she feels, Gentle said.
Do you?
Aping replied, with a fervour in his voice that suggested that art was not, after all, the subject Gentle had been brought here to debate.
You dream too, then?
Everybody does.
That's what my wife used to tell me.
He lowered his voice.
She had prophetic dreams. She knew when she was going to die to the very hour. But I don't dream at all, so I can't share what Huzar feels.
Are you suggesting that maybe I could?
This is a very delicate matter, Aping said. Isodrexian law prohibits all prophetics.
I didn't know that.
Especially women, of course, Aping went on. That's the real reason I keep her out of sight. It's true, she fears the madness, but I'm afraid for what's inside her even more.
Why?
I'm afraid if she keeps company with anyone but me, she'll say something out of turn, and Nashab will realize she has visions like her mother.
And that would be
disastrous. My career would be in tatters. I should never have brought her.
He looked up at Gentle.
I'm only telling you this because we're both artists, and artists have to trust each other, like brothers, isn't that right?
That's right, said Gentle. Aping's large hands were trembling, he saw. The man looked to be on the verge of collapse. Do you want me to speak to your daughter? He asked.
More than that.
Tell me.
I want you to take her with you, when you and the Mistiff leave. Take her to Isodrex.
What makes you think we're going there? Or anywhere come to that?
I have my spies. And so does Nashap. Your plans are better known than you'd like. Take her with you, Mr. Zacharias. Her mother's parents are still alive. They'll look after her.
It's a big responsibility to take a child all that way. Aping pursed his lips.
I would, of course, be able to ease your departure from the island, if you were to take her.
Suppose she won't go, Gentle said.
You must persuade her,
he said, simply, as though he knew Gentle had long experience of persuading little girls to do what he wanted. Nature had played Huzar Aping three cruel tricks. One, it had lent her powers that were expressly forbidden under the Autarch's regime. Two, it had given her a father who, despite his sentimental dotings, cared more for his military career than for her. And three, it had given her a face that only a father could ever have described as beautiful. She was a thin, troubled creature of 9 or 10, her black hair cut comically, her mouth tiny and tight. When, after much cajoling, those lips deigned to speak, her voice was wan and despairing. It was only when Aping told her that her visitor was the man who'd fallen into the sea and almost died that her interest was sparked.
"You went down into the cradle?" she said.
"Yes, I did," Gentle replied, coming to the bed on which she sat, her arms wrapped around her knees.
"Did you see the cradle, lady?"
the girl said.
"See who?"
Aping started to hush her, but Gentle waved him into silence.
"See who?"
he said again.
"She lives in the sea,"
Huzar said.
"I dream about her, and I hear her sometimes. But I haven't seen her yet. I want to see her."
"Does she have a name?" Gentle asked.
"Tishalule,"
Huzar replied, pronouncing the run of the syllables without hesitation.
"That's the sound the waves made when she was born,"
she explained.
"Tishalule."
"That's a lovely name."
"I think so," the girl said gravely. "Better than Huzar."
"Huzar's pretty too," Gentle replied. "Where I come from, Huzar's the noise people make when they're happy."
She looked at him as though the idea of happiness was utterly alien to her, which Gentle could believe. Now he saw Aping in his daughter's presence, he better understood the paradox of the man's response to her. He was frightened of the girl. Her illegal powers upset him, for his reputation's sake certainly, but they also reminded him of a power he had no real mastery over. The man painted Huzar's fragile face over and over, as an act of perverse devotion, perhaps, but also of exorcism.
nor was the child much better served by her gift. Her dreams condemned her to this cell and filled her with obscure longings. She was more their victim than their celebrant. Gentle did his best to draw from her a little more information on this woman, Tisha Lulay, but she either knew very little or was unprepared to vouchsafe further insights in her father's presence. Gentle suspected the latter. As he left, however, she asked him quietly if he would come and visit her again, and he said he would. He found Pai in their cell, with a guard on the door. The mistiff looked grim.
"Nashap's revenge," it said, nodding towards the guard. "I think we've outstayed our welcome."
Gentle recounted his conversation with Aping and the meeting with Hussar.
"So the law prohibits prophetics, does it? That's a piece of legislation I hadn't heard about."
"The way she talked about the cradle lady."
"Her mother, presumably."
"Why do you say that?"
"She's frightened and she wants her mother. Who can blame her? And what's a cradle lady if not her mother?"
"I hadn't thought of it that way," Gentle said. "I suppose there might be some literal truth to what she was saying."
"I doubt it."
"Are we going to take her with us or not?"
"It's your choice, of course. But I say absolutely not."
"Aping said he'd help us if we took her."
"What's his help worth, if we're burdened with a child? Remember, we're not going alone. We've got to get Skopeek out, too, and he's confined to his cell the way we are. Nashap has ordered a general clampdown."
"He must be pining for you."
Pai made a sour face.
"I'm certain our descriptions are on their way to his headquarters even now. And when he gets an answer, he's going to be a very happy Ethak, knowing he's got a couple of desperados and a lock and key. We'll never get out once he knows who we are."
"So we have to escape before he realizes.
I just thank God the telephone never made it to this dominion."
"Maybe the Ordark banned it. The less people talk, the less they can plot. You know, I think maybe I should try and get access to Nashap. I'm sure I could persuade him to give us freer rein if I could just talk with him for a few minutes."
"He's not interested in conversation, Pai," Gentle said. "He'd prefer to keep your mouth busy some other way."
"So you simply want to fight your way out?" Pai replied. "Use Numa against Nashap's men?"
Gentle paused to think this option through.
"I don't think that'd be too clever," he said. "Not with me still weak. In a couple of days maybe we could take them on, but not yet.
We don't have that long."
"I realize that.
And even if we did, we'd be better avoiding a face-to-face conflict. Nashap's troops may be lethargic, but there's a good number of them."
"Perhaps you should see him then and try to mellow him a little. I'll talk to Aping and praise his pictures some more."
"Is he any good?"
"Put it this way. As a painter, he makes a damn fine father. But he trusts me, with us being fellow artists and all."
The mistiff got up and called to the guard, requesting a private interview with Captain Nashap. The man mumbled something smutty and left his post, having first beaten the bolts on the door with his rifle butt to be certain they were firmly in place. The sound drove Gentle to the window to stare out at the open air. There was a brightness in the cloud layer that suggested the suns might be on their way through. The mistiff joined him, slipping its arms around his neck.
"What are you thinking?" it said.
"Remember Efreet's mother, in Beatrix?"
"Of course.
She told me she dreamt about me coming to sit at her table, though she wasn't certain whether I'd be a man or a woman."
"Naturally, you are deeply offended."
"I would have been once," Gentle said. "But it didn't mean that much when she said it. After a few weeks with you, I didn't give a shit what sex I was. See how you've corrupted me?"
"My pleasure,"